ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasadudale Sri Vani Bhakta Vedanta Swami Niti Namani Namaste Saraswata Deva Gauravani Prachadane Namaste Shashanga Vani Pasadade Shatadane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Niti Nanda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasudhi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 17, Verse 15. Anagasiha bhuteshu Yagas krin nirankusaha Ahartasmi bhujam sakshan Amartasyapi Sangadam Anagasu Iha to the offenseless Bhuteshu living beings Ya the person Aga Krit commit offense Nirankusa upstart Aharta Asmi I shall bring forth bhujam, arms, sakshat, directly, amartasya, api, even one who is a demigod, saangadam, with decorations and armor. Translation. An upstart living being who commits offenses by torturing those who are offenseless shall be directly uprooted by me, even though he be a denizen of heaven with armor and decorations. Purport, the denizens of the heavenly kingdom are called Amara or deathless due to their possessing a long lifespan of life far greater than that of human beings. For a human being who has only a maximum 100 year duration of life, the span of life spreading over millions of years is certainly considered to be deathless. For example, from Bhagavad Gita we learn that on the Brahmaloka planet the duration of one day is calculated to be 4,300,000 times 1,000 solar years. Similarly, in other heavenly planets one day is calculated to be 6 months of this planet and the inhabitants get a life of 10 million of their years. Therefore, in all higher planets, since the lifespan is far greater than that of the human being, the denizens are called deathless by imagination, although actually no one within the material universe is deathless. Maharaj Parikshit challenges even such denizens of heaven if they torture the offenseless. This means that the state executive head must be as strong as Maharaj Parikshit, so that he may be determined to punish the strongest offenders. It should be the principle of a state executive head that the offender of the codes of God is always punished. Translation, upstart living being who commits offenses by torturing those who are offenseless shall be directly uprooted by me, even though he be a denizen of heaven with armor and decorations. So here, Parikshit is stating his intention to annihilate any person who harms the offenseless, even if that person is a demigod. So he has used the word amartya, which means deathless, to indicate a demigod. And Prabhupada has commented here that actually the demigod is not deathless, but he lives a long period of time relative to the people on earth at this moment. Of course, if we examine previous histories, like Priyavrata, he lived for millions of years also, and he was on this earth planet. So it's not just 100 years for us, but our particular yuga is, and this particular time is maybe 100 years for a person, which is quite short compared to others. So the scriptures also talk about the going to Svargaloka and becoming immortal. And it's particularly stated in the Karmakanda section of the Vedas. And the Karmakandis, that is the followers of Jaimini, Purva Mimamsakas, they use such statements to encourage everyone to follow Karmakanda and get elevated to Svargaloka, because you can become immortal. So of course this is a mistake of the interpretation of the word, but nevertheless, based on that mistake, they have built a whole philosophy, which is a whole section of the, using a whole section of the Vedas, the Purva Mimamsa section of the Vedas, the Brahmanas and Aranyakas, and the parts of the Veda which encourage such things. So they've used, taken the word literally. The Devata, or one who's on Svargaloka, is deathless, to mean that he actually has eternal life in that body. However, if we look in other scriptures, we'll find it's not so. And we know from Bhagavad Gita that even Brahma has a lifespan of a certain number of years, and he has to give up the body also. And if we look at the larger picture, we see the universe is created and destroyed, and each time there's a Brahma born and Brahma dies, a Brahma born and Brahma dies. And within that we have shorter lifespans. So if the highest living entity, Brahma, has to die, what to speak of devatas and human beings and others? They all must die. Well, the reason, of course, is that they have material bodies. And usually material bodies are subject to karma. And by the law of karma, everyone has to have an end to that body. It's simply one of the laws of karma. You have a certain lifespan. So by the law of karma, you can't get an infinite lifespan. It doesn't work. You have to have a lifespan of maybe a million years or a billion years, or life of Brahma, a life of a devata, or a life of a human being, 100 years, 50 years, 80 years, 20 years, whatever. There's a limit. It's not unlimited. It's not infinite. And that's the law of karma. You have to have a body that has a limitation. So, therefore it is ultimately futile to attempt to live eternally in the material world. So this, of course, has been a quest, not only in India, but also in other countries. They're looking for this, the philosopher's stone that can make you immortal, or something, alchemy. I think in alchemy, which was, even Newton did alchemy, by the way. Along with his scientific research, he was doing alchemy. And one of the whole ideas of this is to get immortality. And the Greeks were also interested in this, and other persons as well. It's there in Chinese Taoist philosophy. You try to become immortal by doing the Taoist, sadhana, like yoga, operating with the body. And in yoga itself, the idea is there that somehow you can extend your life for long periods of time until you can almost become immortal in this body. The idea of becoming immortal is very attractive to the human being that has a temporary body. But unfortunately, it is ultimately impossible. The best you can do is have a long period of life, like the yogi or the devata or Lord Brahma. That's the maximum you can do. So, what is the point of having that long lifespan? The point is, of course, that death itself is unattractive to everybody. Everybody gets attracted to their life in this particular body, and they don't want it to end. In most cases, unless you commit suicide. But most people want to extend their life. In spite of the fact that it may not be that great. It has its imperfections. So that, of course, is quite evident on our sphere, and the Bhumandala sphere in Varsha, very evident that there's lots of imperfections and we get sickness and so many catastrophes, etc. If we go upwards, it is less evident. So if you go to Svargaloka, then you don't get all the sickness, etc., and old age. So it's a little better. So then you would be very attached to that life. But then you have to die. So that's not very welcome. After all that period of time, then you have to give up that wonderful body and die and fall back down to the earth planet or something. So that's the problem with that long lifespan. Once you get attached to that body, you don't want to leave it. So human beings are attached to their body. What to speak of those on upper planets, and they'll be attached to their body like anything because they're living such a peaceful, wonderful life. So extending your life is not a real solution, because when you have to give up your body again, and then you have to suffer that pain of giving up your body. Not maybe physical pain, but the pain of, oh, it's ending now and I don't want to give up this life, this experience. So there's no real solution in the material world for this problem of death, in spite of the fact that we do have a long life. So that's the nature of the material world. And as I mentioned the other day, by the will of the Lord, we have all these cycles of destruction. The immediate body destruction, and then the bigger destruction with the Manvantaras, and the bigger destruction with the day of Brahma, and the bigger destruction with the lifetime of Brahma. And everybody gets destroyed completely for a long period of time. There's another destruction, which is a solution to the problem. This is the Achantika destruction, the final destruction. But it does not take place for the whole universe. It can take place for the individual and his material body. That means you get liberated from the material world. So that's the only solution to the problem, actually, where you get out of the material world and you don't take a material body. And then you have reached the stage of being immortal. So that becomes the quest, even in the Varnashram system. We have Artha, Dharma, Kama, and then we have Moksha. So that's the higher goal within the material system of Dharma or Varnashram, to go for Moksha. Get out of the material world. Stop the karma, stop the birth and death, stop the material body, and then you have immortality. Because a lot of people, most people in the world, cannot really appreciate this idea that, oh, I'm not the body and I become immortal when I separate from my body, then they're given these other things, artha, dharma, kama. Satisfy your desires, do dharma, get your material needs satisfied, live happily in this body. This is artha, dharma, kama. It is a little different from regular material life that we know now, because there is dharma mixed up in it. So modern material life is artha, kama. No dharma. So the Varnashram says it's artha, dharma, kama. We got the dharma in there also, which means restriction. Of course, even in modern society, in material society, we do have some dharma in the sense that the government has laws. And if you kill somebody, then you get put in jail or whatever like this. So we have some very minimum dharma. But in the Varnashram system, there is more rules and regulations. And also it's a little different, because there's discrimination there between the people. It's not everybody's equal. Different people have different sets of rules and restrictions. Sudras have one set of rules, are more liberal for them. The Vaishyas and the Kshatriyas and the Brahmanas. Brahmanas, a lot of restrictions. So not everybody's equal. The people at the top got more rules and regulations to follow. The people at the bottom have less rules to follow. It's just a little different. It's not everybody has the same rules, minimum rules. No. People at the top got a lot of rules to follow. So here Prabhupada's talking about the Kshatriyas, you know, real king all have to institute dharma properly and, punish the offenders and make sure that the innocent people are protected and things like this. So Kshatriyas are upper. They got more rules to follow. There's no obligation at the sudra to do such a thing. He doesn't have, he's no responsibility to protect anybody. Yeah? But the kshatriya has that responsibility. And of course the brahmana has even more responsibility. So, and he has more rules to follow, more sense control. Everything. Kshatriya is allowed to drink and whatever, do so many things. And then the brahmana has, you know, got a lot of restrictions on him. So, that is dharma. Kama and artha are allowed within the rules of dharma. That is the varnashram system. But the ultimate goal is to get to moksha, to reject everything. Which sounds a little strange. You're trying to get your material desires fulfilled and then suddenly you renounce everything. So that's the varnashram system. It is enraged in such a way that when you get to the top and you become a brahmana, then you naturally, as the nature of a sattvic person, he will think, he will have knowledge. Prakasha it is called in the Bhagavad Gita. And he has two things, prakasha and this sense of enjoyment. It's not material enjoyment in the normal sense. It's not knowledge in the normal sense. The knowledge is he understands he's not the body. And sattvic one. There's something other than this material body. I know there's something else. And this sattvic person. Not by teaching so much as by intuition. He has that feeling, I'm not the material body actually. This material body is not so important. And consequently, his sense of enjoyment is different. He doesn't get enjoyment from gross material sense objects, eating and drinking and doing all these things. He thinks enjoyment must be somewhere inside, inner enjoyment. Yeah, that's the Atma. So that is natural to a sattvic person. Consequently, he's qualified for rejecting the material body completely, rejecting karma, destroying karma, and getting liberation. Yeah. So the Artha Dharma Kama, that's for sudras, vaishyas, kshatriyas, and moksha for the brahman. Okay. So an interesting system, because built into that material system is a little element of non-material thing, that's reject the material world and get moksha. So it's quite a, in that sense, quite an advanced material system that allows you to get out of the material world. So that is one solution to the problem built into the Vedic civilization, the Varnashram civilization, that it tells you how to become immortal. Really. Not just going to Svargaloka and doing all that. It gives you a real solution. The Atantika, destruction of your gross and subtle bodies permanently. So that's a unique feature of the Varnashram system, which is generally called material, but it ends up by being spiritual in one sense. The misfortune of that system is it doesn't get to the next stage, which is prema. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, oh, this Varnashram system, what's the use? There's a fifth goal, which is not mentioned there. That is called prema. Not just moksha. Not get out of the material body, but prema. To establish a relationship with the Supreme Lord, which gives rise to the highest bliss. So, in one sense, we get moksha and you get bliss. What is the bliss? The bliss is the Atma is separated from the material body, gross and subtle. Consequently, no death, birth, old age, disease, pain, etc. So that's peaceful. That's blissful in one sense. But it's not a real positive bliss. So the real bliss for the Atma comes when he establishes a relationship with the Supreme Lord. Through that relationship, the Lord bestows bhakti, which matures into prema. And that gives rise to ananda, or bliss, positive bliss in that relationship. The interaction of jiva with the Supreme Lord in a pure state of love gives rise to the greatest bliss. So that is real ananda. So prema is considered to be the highest purushartha, the highest goal, and artha, dharma, kama, moksha are considered inferior. Of course, moksha is superior to artha, dharma, and kama. But prema is considered to be the ultimate goal. or purushartha. Without that, then one is a failure. So that is why Lord Chaitanya rejected the Varnashram system, because it doesn't get to prema. So, therefore the Vedic system is there, but it's not complete. The system of Karma Yoga, Varnashram, Dharma is not complete. It is a step. Comprising Karma Yoga and then Jnana Yoga and maybe Asanga Yoga in there. It doesn't get to the final step of Bhakti Yoga. So that is why Lord Chaitanya often criticizes it. So, therefore, the real solution to the problem of being immortal is not just get rid of your material body, but also, in that state of deathlessness without the material body, to experience the highest bliss. Now, of course, you can say, well, as devotees, we shouldn't want bliss because then we're, you know, trying to be happy or whatever. And it looks like we're, you know, asking God for something. But ultimately, it is the nature of the jiva to aspire for bliss, a happy state. Okay? We say, you know, the jiva Satchitananda. So he doesn't really have ananda at this stage. And even in moksha, doesn't have real ananda. Brahmananda is not real ananda. It's an absence of the material suffering. Okay? But the jiva by nature does not like all these experiences in the material world of pain and death and lamentation and whatnot, all these problems. And we see naturally everybody tries to avoid these things. And everybody's striving for happiness. Everybody wants happiness. Unfortunately, we use the wrong means. So we're trying to get happiness through our senses with sense objects and think this is happiness or that is happiness or this is happiness. That's illusory happiness. But nevertheless, the goal of the jiva is happiness. We're misdirected in doing so. And that's called our conditioned state, bahirmukha. Happiness without the Lord, turned away from the Lord, turned opposite the Lord, and turning in the direction of matter. And we're trying to be happy. So the desire to be happy, or the aspiration to be happy, is natural to the jiva. But we're directed in the wrong place. We're directed to material objects. And we're trying to get happiness for ourselves in this way. So, if the jiva wants that happiness, yes, it's not a problem. We can encourage the jiva to be happy and to get bliss as it goes. So that's why it's a purushartha. In fact, all of these things are purushartas for getting bliss. Artha. To get material objects so we can be happy in the material world. To get kama, to fulfill the other extra desires beyond your bare existence. That's also to get your pleasure. And moksha is there for pleasure also, ultimately for the bliss of the jiva. On different levels, you know, we get the lowest level, the higher level, then the higher level, like that. And then the highest level is prema. Okay? So, we cannot separate jiva from the idea of getting happiness. But, the moment that the jiva thinks, I want some happiness for myself, then there's a problem. We try to go to the material world and get objects for ourselves, we get things for ourselves. I want for myself, and we take things for ourselves. And then we're in the material world. So, to get the opposite, that is to end up with prema and get that type of enjoyment, then the enjoyment has to be secondary. We cannot say, I want my enjoyment. Okay? We say, I will give the enjoyment to the Supreme Lord. Then we get the enjoyment. So that's the only way we can get eternal enjoyment, not by trying to get it for ourselves. By serving the Lord, then we can get our enjoyment. Why is it like that? Why do we have to say, well, I've got to give to somebody else, not myself? That's just the nature of things. It's the nature of the jiva. The jiva is made like that. This constitution to be dependent on the Lord, not that he's independent. I get my enjoyment separately. It's not his nature. He's an amsa of the Lord, eternally, and it can never be changed. So therefore, if he really wants that highest bliss, and he also deserves it, and he can get it, then he has to submit voluntarily to the Lord and say, yes, I am your servant, I want to serve you. So this, of course, is not unnatural. It is not some sort of slavery. We will find reflections on this in the material world. That the real happiness is not when we try to get for ourselves. So on one level we have humanitarian type activities in which we try to do good for others. And then we get a sense of satisfaction that way, which is higher than the satisfaction of simply, stuffing your mouth with food or stimulating your eyes with videos or something like that. When you actually do something for somebody else without any expectation, then you feel a higher sort of satisfaction. So that is why, even in the Varnashram system, which is as a basic material, it is cleverly arranged to encourage you to do punyas all the time. Charity works, all these stuff of humanitarian activities. You have to do this, you have to do this for others, you have to give. And if you got bad karmas, then the solution, the prayaschitta, the atonement for that is you got to give something. It may be giving to other people, it may be making wells or planting trees or putting up streetlights or whatever, or it may be giving to the devatas even. So there's devata worship required. You have to give something. Not for yourself. You give things away like this. It's inculcated in all the varnas, so the sudras or the vaishyas, and even more for the kshatriyas, they have to be generous and have to give things. Like karna, bound to give up things, give charity like this. So it's encouraged in the system. Even the brahmana, he gets everything and then he gives it all away. So that is the idea of some sort of higher sense of happiness from not doing for the self. The other reflection, of course, is in relationships of love in the material world. So the ideal there is not to get something for the self, but rather simply serve the other person. And Prabhupada often remarks that the relationship of the mother to the baby is ideal, we could say the purest in the material world, because the mother doesn't want to exploit the child. She simply serves the child out of great love. And she feeds the child, and the child cries, and she tries to comfort the child. And she's not thinking, well, I'm doing this because I want the child to do something for me. Don't think like that. She's doing it for her, the child. So this is an example where we don't try to get something for ourselves in a relationship. So this is what we term a relationship of love. Unfortunately, in the material world, there's always some sort of hidden motive for the self also. So it's not absolutely pure, but there is some reflection of real love there. So therefore, the relationship of the Lord is the real love, the pure love, without any tinge of selfish motive behind it. So because of that, that's we can say it's the difficulty in achieving perfection in bhakti, to get to the level of prema, to get that spotless type of relationship. As I said, we have relationships of love in the material world. It was kind of pure. There's a little bit of mixture there. But same with bhakti. In the material world, because of our material contamination, we can do bhakti. But there's some contamination there. To get it absolutely pure, that requires effort. To get to that level of pure love of Krishna, that requires effort. So therefore, it takes time to get from the first level of bhakti, Shraddha, and then bhakti, sadhana, to get to bhava and to get to prema. It takes some effort, it takes some time, because we have to remove all of that impurity and we have to cultivate that relationship. So actually there's two things. One is removing impurities, the other is to encourage the love. If we just simply remove the impurities, what we get is moksha. Remove the karmas, remove the desires, remove the ahankara, remove the material body, subtle and gross. Moksha, Brahman. So simply removing all your impurities is not enough. Unfortunately, the system of bhakti is such that it removes the purities without thinking about it. You don't have to think about it. Whereas in jnana and yogi, you do have to make your major effort to remove the impurities. So that takes place in bhakti while
we do the major effort of bhakti, which is to cultivate the relationship with the Lord. That is the major factor in bhakti, not the removal of the karmas and all that. That's secondary. That takes place by itself. So the major effort in bhakti is to establish that pure relationship. And automatically, the obstacles begin to disappear. That's the first symptom of bhakti, klesha, destruction of kleshas. Kleshas meaning karmas, desires, ahankara, etc. So that takes place as we perform the sadhana of bhakti, like hearing, chanting, remembering, deity worship, etc. takes place. So, therefore, the real goal is prema. That's how we get our immortality with bliss. Not just immortal, that is moksha. We get immortality with the highest type of bliss. And so that is the real solution to this problem here of trying to become immortal. That's the final solution. So we should not stop part way and just get to the Varnashram system. We have to come to the highest system, that is a system of bhakti. We have a modification of Varnashram, what we call Daivi Varnashram. So this is a Varnashram system, but there is also within that system definitely an amount of bhakti. Actually, it is said that the Varnashram system doesn't operate if there isn't some bhakti anyway, even if we don't call it Varnashram. It must be some bhakti there. If you don't have any bhakti there at all, the Lord doesn't give it any blessing and therefore won't work. So whether it's Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Stanga Yoga, or Bhakti Yoga, there has to be mercy of the Lord there in the form of some respect for the Lord and some bhakti. A little bit, at least. So it cannot be completely, let's reject the Lord and not worship the Lord at all, and insult Him or say He's a material entity. If you do that, then you don't get any results for all your efforts, even in Varnashram, or Yoga, or Jnana. So there must be some element of bhakti. However, if it is made more and more prominent, then we can call it this Daivi Varnashram, where there is everyone is encouraged to worship the Supreme Lord. So they, in other words, they perform bhakti, and along with that, they perform the Varnashram system as a means of their livelihood, etc. So that is permissible as long as, as far as bhakti is concerned, as long as those other elements of Varnashram do not conflict with the goals of bhakti. Yeah? Because I said, Artha Dharma Kama definitely in themselves are material, so they will conflict if we're trying to get artha only. If we start emphasizing the artha, 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 or the kama, 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 or whatever, then we end up with very mixed bhakti, karma, mistra, bhakti. Someone can practice, but we should not be too attached to the goals of these different elements that we perform in the Varnashram system. And it's permissible. However, even without those elements, one can do bhakti and succeed. It's not that it depends upon a Varnashram system. You can do it with the Varnashram system, you can do it without the Varnashram system, either way. And if you do it with the Varnashram system, then you shouldn't get tangled up in all those desires of the Varnashram system of moksha or material assets. Okay? And if you do it without any Varnashram system or any part of Jnana or Yoga in it, it's just pure bhakti, even then there's a problem. You can mix the gunas with your bhakti. So you can get tamagun bhakti, rajagun bhakti, and sattvagun bhakti also, even without practicing elements of karma. Again, in other words, you can carry over desires for liberation, even in just doing bhakti without anything else. You can still desire liberation. Then it's impure still. Or you can desire some material things when you're doing your bhakti without incorporating Varnashram elements at all. Still, it's impure. So it's like karma, mistra, bhakti anyway, because of your desires, your intentions. And so the real bhakti, which is advocated in the Bhagavatam, is that pure bhakti, which means no other desires. And you can practice the other elements, like the great kings, like Ambarish, he did his Varnashrams as a king, etc., but not attached to it at all. He was attached to the bhakti. And he had no other desires mixed in that bhakti. So whether we do other elements of karma or jnana or yoga with the bhakti or not, not really the factor. The factor is that the bhakti remains pure and we don't have any other aspiration except to serve the Lord and try to please Him. That will give us the highest goal. If we start mixing it, we also get something extraordinary in one sense, but not as high. So we'll get better than the jnani. We'll get better than the karmi. The karmi can go to Svargaloka or Brahmaloka if he also worships the Lord a little bit. That's his ultimate in karma yoga. In jnana yoga, you can get moksha. And in yoga, astanga yoga also, you can get moksha. So one who does bhakti, karma, Mr. Bhakti, jnana, Mr. Bhakti, yoga, Mr. Bhakti, will get more than the karmi or the jnani and the yogi. In other words, he'll get more than Svargaloka or Brahmaloka. He'll get more than moksha. He'll get more than Brahman. But he'll get less than the person who practices pure bhakti. So that, where does he go then? Above Brahman, but less than Goloka. So he goes to the spiritual world. And he can get Salokya and Sarsti. And Sarupya. So he can get a spiritual form, he can be in the spiritual world, he can get all sorts of powers. This is the karma Mr. Bhakta. He can get in the spiritual world and he can. And the Lord, of course, purifies him so he hasn't got any material desires, because the mixture creates a weakness in the relationship with the Lord. So he gets more than the jnani, more than moksha, but his relationship with the Lord is weak in the spiritual world. So therefore he ends in this position where he doesn't really directly serve the Lord at all, but he's got a spiritual body in the spiritual world and he meditates on the Lord, things like that. So he's there. He got some peace and joy, whatever, but we don't call it prema. And the jnani, jnanavis or bhakta, because of some mixture elements of wanting liberation and peaceful, no birth, no death, old age, disease type of thing, he gets shanta rasa. In the spiritual world, he gets a rasa, but it's shanta rasa, where he can even meet the Lord, but he's in a very state of peacefulness all the time. There's no disturbance. So, in other words, bhakti in any form is superior to the other sadhanas of karma, jnana, and yoga, but the best is to do pure bhakti. Then you establish a relationship with the Lord, a direct relationship with prema. And it was with Krishna, and then you get, of course, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, or Madhurya. Intimate rasas of the Lord, which give real bliss in the spiritual world. So therefore, Bhagavatam recommends that pure bhakti only as the sadhana for everyone. Do that, and then we get the purusharta, we get the highest bliss. So that means the capacity of the jiva has reached its maximum when we do pure bhakti. And we get the prema out of that. Okay, any question? Oh, well, today is the, actually the appearance day was yesterday. And then, of course, nighttime. So the next day, after the appearance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Jagannath Mishra, his father, performed the birth ceremony, just as Nanda Maharaj, after Krishna's birth, performed a big festival for Krishna. We'll see in the Bhagavatam a description of how Nanda Maharaj, out of his great joy, invited everybody there, and there was exchange of gifts, etc., celebration. And meanwhile, in the prison house, Vasudeva was meditating on giving cows away and doing many things, but he couldn't do anything because he was in the prison. But they had some sort of celebration. So similarly, in Chaitanya's pastimes, when he was born, Jagannath Mishra and his wife, they celebrated, invited their friends and everyone there, and they gave charity away, etc., and blessed the child in different ways by offering different things according to Vedic rituals. Different elements of purification and things were there. And all the women came and blessed the child, were joyful on seeing the child. so similar because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu comes as Chan Avatar, covered avatar. He is treated like a normal person in the world. So Jagannath Misra's and his family follow the rituals of their particular family, their Brahmin family in Bengal at that time, and they did all the rituals according to their, you know, the customs then, and acted like a normal child. So our, of course, we see that afterwards, gradually, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu began to manifest certain signs which were a little extraordinary, such as his footprints on the ground, and they had the shankha and chakra on them, etc. And he would cry until they chanted the name of Krishna, etc. So as he grew up, there were certain indications, but he never revealed directly his powers or anything. And so he acted like a child, a normal child. And we see even with Krishna, the same thing happened. Krishna never displayed his powers in such a way that the people of Raja would think that he's not their son. So Yasoda always thought of Krishna as her son, even though he's killed Putana and Trinavarta and Sakatasura, etc. He did it in such a way that nobody thought that he was anything but their child. So he also acted as a human being. So in either case, the parents thought him as their child, not as Supreme Lord. Depends on what the impure desires are and how it is practiced. Now, in nectar devotion, there of course the basic definition is anabhilashita shunya, yeah, which technically we could say could not take place unless you got prema. So any stage before that, there's some impurity, whether it's bhava or sadhana. But nevertheless, the word this ananya bhakti is used for sadhana and bhava and prema, pure bhakti. The same word is used for all three. So the indication is that you cannot get to that pure stage unless you begin with a pure motive, even if you're not pure. So if you don't have an understanding of this definition in the beginning, and you just practice bhakti, something like that, then probably you're going to end up with a mixed bhakti. And then you're not going to end up with that ananya bhakti at the end. You're going to end up in the spiritual world, maybe at the end, finally with your perfection. But you'll be, you know, forearm Vishnu form like that, Vishnu Dutta form, without a direct relationship with the Lord, without experiencing prema as a result. So therefore, sadhana itself needs to be done with an awareness of that purity, even though we're not 100% pure. Until prema, still in that sadhana stage, which goes through anarshana, vritti, anishta, ruchi, asakti, etc. Still, we're not pure, but it is called pure bhakti. If we accept that definition and attempt to practice with that definition, so in that sense, it's pure bhakti, even in the beginning. Whereas another person will not have that definition, and he's doing his bhakti, and he has desires to get things and praise to the Lord for this and that and whatever all the time, so for material things. So. But that's he'll get a different goal ultimately, unless he associates with devotees who practice pure bhakti and develops a higher conception. So in if we don't perfect in this lifetime practicing according to the definition of Rupa Goswami, then we continue next lifetime. And that's generally the mode. Sadhana bhakti means we practice until we get to the stage of prema. When we get prema, then we're qualified for the spiritual world. The other process is kripa. Kripa of the devotee, they can elevate us immediately to bhava, or in the case of Murgari the hunter, in 3 months he went from zero to bhava. Grace of Narada Muni. In some cases you go to the spiritual world. Krishna gave Kripa to Putana, and she ended up in the spiritual world with the spiritual body. But that's extraordinary mercy. So the usual case is that we go gradually, and it may take lifetimes until we get prema. You know, if they continue until they get perfection, and the Lord takes them to the spiritual world at that point, then they'll end up with, you know, an abhas of prema in the spiritual world. That is just a slight similarity to prema with, you know, spiritual body, but no direct relationship, or shantarasa maybe also.
Do they have to cross They have to.
So in other words, you could practice karma mistra bhakti and yet end up at a stage of, we won't call it asakti, etc., because they don't develop that same attachment to the Lord, but they can become purified. Even chanting the holy name of Ajamil, he got all his karmas destroyed, so he's qualified for liberation immediately. So the devotee also is qualified for liberation, but of course he wants more than that, so the Lord can take him to the spiritual world, but at the same time, he won't get the same position. Same relationship with the Lord.
So when we truly say that we should forget all other considerations, material considerations, considerations of mortality or our level of bhakti or this or that,
yeah,
and just develop our loving relationship with Krishna, this is the only way we're going to get from the anymore. Develop a loving relationship with Krishna, Krishna reciprocates, we can simply have prema, all our service being automatically followed because we love Krishna.
It looks like that, appears like that, because one manvantara of 71 yuga cycles has a whole set of devatas, the manu, the sages, etc., that they all last that time, and then there's another set comes in for the next manvantara. So 14 times in one day of Brahma, the devatas change, along with the sages, the great sages. It doesn't say, but I would think they would give up the body at that time, unless in some cases they progress and they do something, take another post or something after that period of time. Generally, it looks like they that's the extent of their body. In any case, they wouldn't last beyond the day of Brahma, because the day of Brahma everybody dies. Everyone disappears.
Whoever gets killed by Krishna, they will go to
who?
Aristasur.
Oh, does it say that, right?
I'll
have to look at the commentary for that, what it means. But generally, not necessary liberation and say mukti. They can also go to the spiritual world. Like Agasura got a forearm form in the spiritual world. Putana became a nurse in the spiritual world. So they could get mukti, that is the Brahman realization of liberation, or they could get a spiritual world. But even if they get a forearm in the spiritual world, they are inferior to those who practice bhakti and go to the spiritual world. So the relationship again is very mild relationship, with weak relationship with the Lord in comparison to those who practice bhakti and go to the spiritual world with prema. So it's not we can all aspire to become demons and get killed by Krishna and go to the spiritual world. You could, but then you would have a weak relationship with the Lord. Or he may not even take you there, he may put you in Brahman instead. Oh, I think probably he goes Yamraj means he died. That's what it means. It's not figurative. It's a figurative expression. It means he died. Gave up his material body. That's what the Yamaraj. Yeah, it means he died. He gave up his mortal coil and then got liberated or whatever.
The devotees who attained Vaikuntha, did they get an opportunity to take into increase their relationship?
Theoretically, it's possible, because in spiritual world, we're called satya sankalpa. Any desire is fulfilled. You could take any body in the literal sense, and that's discussed in the Brahma Sutras and the Upanishads, that you can take any form you want. If you want to be a dog, you can be a dog. If you want to be a tree, you can be a tree. You can sit around in any form you want. You know, like, it's free, you're free. But then the counter to that is that usually the devotees who are serious practice, and during the practice, they establish a relationship, a preferred relationship with the Supreme Lord in particular form, such as Ramchandra or with Krishna or whatever. And that's the form they want to fix themselves on, so they don't worry about using their satya sankalpa ability to keep changing their forms. They prefer simply to stick to one form and get the highest bliss out of that. And that's where they're satisfied most, and then they would stick to that particular form. Generally we don't, because, in other words, you could take any form there because you have that ability, but generally the devotees don't do that because they establish a strong relationship in a particular, with a particular form like Ramchandra or Krishna, and they don't want to, they don't prefer anything else. So the people in Vaikuntha, they have a relationship with Vishnu and they don't think of anything else. They don't think, oh, I have to have a relationship with Krishna today and change their form. They don't do that because they've established a relationship with Vishnu and they're very satisfied with that. That's like their, we can say their sarupa at that point. But theoretically it's possible to take any forms. It's discussed in Brihad Bhagavatamrita also that they can take any form they want to, but I said that's maybe just for some leela or something, but generally they don't do that. They're just fixed with their particular deity at that point. Yeah, so what we practice usually is what we get. This is, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, you attain what you remember when you die, what's in your mind when you die, then you become that. So in the greater sense, when you practice a relationship, a particular relationship with a particular deity, life after life, or until you get perfection, when you pass out of your body, then that's what you get. It's because you establish that form. Well, we see in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says four types of people come to me, and two of those have material desires, and one has a desire for liberation or whatever. Yeah? So they're mixed, but he says, I accept them all. So Krishna is pleased in any case, whether you do bhakti rather than if you don't do bhakti. He's pleased with bhakti. Of course, he's pleased with all systems in the Vedas, whether it's karma yoga, jnana yoga, astanga yoga, or bhakti, but he's more pleased if you do bhakti, but he's most pleased if you do pure bhakti. So it's a matter of degrees of how he's pleased. So he really surrenders to the pure bhakta rather than the others. Well, that's a possibility. The other possibility is he empowers somebody else. because we can't speak, you know, we can't think with a limited material mind. You know, he's stuck in one position, whatever. He can empower somebody, or Krishna can empower another person to act on his behalf. In one sense, guru is one. So it's not just guru is a particular person, it's actually a tattva. And that function can be given to any jiva in the material world by the mercy of Krishna. So in that sense, he can extend himself to other persons as well in terms of guidance in life after life.
So we can have a few extra rules.
Yeah, in any case, he wouldn't have the same body. A material body anyway, you know, like that. So you probably wouldn't recognize him. To get Krishna prema in this lifetime, or diksha is there, but I think we have maybe a little bit of a misconception or overblown conception of what it is. If we look in the scripture itself, like Rupa Goswami, or Jiva Goswami, and then Bhakti Sandhya, he talks about the Shiksha Guru, the Shravana Guru, the Mantra Guru, which is the Diksha Guru. So the Mantra Guru is the one who gives a not Hare Krishna mantra, but deity mantras, which we generally get at second initiation. And the function is for meditation and deity worship. So basically the mantra guru or the diksha guru is the guru who gives you the right to worship the deity. So that's a pancharatrik element. On the other hand, our sampradaya also has the element of the holy name, which is called Bhagavata Marga. So we have two margas, Pancharatrika Marga, deity worship, and we have Bhagavata Marga, chanting the holy name, Hare Krishna. That Bhagavata Marga does not require diksha. In other words, we tell everybody to chant the holy name without giving them diksha. And most people, they have to chant for 6 months anyway before they get diksha. So, or longer, maybe years or whatever. So it doesn't require diksha. So we're doing two things, where we can practice Pancharatrika Marga and Bhagavata Marga. Now the emphasis, because it's the Yuga Dharma, is the Bhagavata Marga rather than the Pancharatrika system. So, is it necessary to take diksha to get prema? Theoretically, no, because the holy name itself gives prema. Everything is in the holy name. The name has the form, qualities, activities of Krishna and rasa with Krishna within it. So by the sadhana of the holy name, yes, you can get. Now, of course, the holy name itself requires shiksha in order to get the proper conception of what is bhakti and how to chant and who is Krishna. And to develop a relationship, you would need some guru of some sort. So you can't reject guru in one sense, but it may not be a diksha guru, it may be a shiksha guru. So along with the holy name or Bhagavata Marga, you do need some shiksha guru also. At least that's there. However, though that is so, that it's independent of diksha, Jiva Goswami also says generally the two are combined, and even though we chant the holy name, we also worship the deity. And the reason for that is that people's minds are unsettled in the material world and distracted, but therefore they need engagement of their senses. So deity worship offers an opportunity to engage the senses, so generally we do deity worship along with the Bhagavata Marga of chanting Hare Krishna. So therefore the two things go together. Generally you take diksha along with chanting the holy name. That's maybe the Jiva Goswami's explanation. So technically no, but in practical terms generally yes, and therefore we see in our sampradaya though we emphasize the chanting of the holy name, it doesn't require diksha. Probably everybody took diksha, except maybe Haridas Thakur. There could be a few other examples, I don't know, but generally they do take diksha also. Lord Chaitanya took diksha, for instance. Whatever. So generally they take diksha, but it's not an absolute requirement. But what is required is, along with chanting the holy name, is to get the proper instructions, at least through a shiksha guru. So some guru is necessary, anyway.
could you explain the Buddhism and how to counteract that? Because they say that it's said Prabhupada that you don't need to take diksha.
Yeah, well, I think the idea there is the misconception of diksha. Because they say that diksha means to give divyaganam and destruction of sin, which is in that definition, divyagami yato dadat, which is quoted in the Bhakti Sandarbha also. But, yes, the diksha guru gives divyaganam and destroys sin. So then the claim is that only Prabhupada can do that. He can only destroy sin and give divyaganam. No one else can do that. The counter argument is that if you look at the next verse that's quoted in the Bhakti Sandarbha, it says, therefore you approach the guru, offer everything to him, and get the mantra from him. And then the commentary on that is Jiva Goswami is in the mantra, you get your divyaganam. Which means the mantra obviously for us is Krishna mantra. And our relationship was in servant of Krishna. Your relationship was established with your particular deity. So we get Krishna mantra and we establish our relation of being the servant of Krishna through the mantra. That's our divyaganam, which destroys the sin. So therefore, that's one way of getting divyaganam through diksha, through the mantra, because the main element of the diksha is the mantra. The other way of destroying sin and getting divyaganam is by shiksha. Otherwise, what is shiksha if it's not divyaganam? If it's material knowledge, then why have it at all? Why have shiksha guru at all if he gives material knowledge, not divyaganam? And divyaganam by its nature is bhakti, so it destroys sin. Any type of bhakti will destroy sin. And of course, sin is destroying sin is not what we want anyway. That's a secondary aspect, as I said, like liberation. That gives liberation itself. So we're not aspiring for that anyway. It's one of the qualities. The only reason it's mentioned in diksha is because it's for the word chak. Diksha, div for divya, ganam, ksha for kshaya, destruction of sin, papasya sankshaya. So therefore, diksha means that you get a mantra and through that you get your relationship with Krishna and then consequently you destroy sin and by chanting the mantra you establish a relationship with Krishna and get prema. That's one way. So the main element of the diksha guru is giving the mantra. That allows you to get your divyaganam and destroy your sin. It's not that the and of course he gives you teachings concerning the mantra and how to worship the deity. It's up to the disciple actually to carry out the process of chanting the mantra properly, worshipping the deity properly, doing bhakti properly. Then he destroys sin and progresses to prema. It's not that he gets zapped by the guru immediately, suddenly divyaganam and destroy your sin. The process of bhakti is the destroying element, anarjana vritti, etc. So, you can get, in other words, it's not a limitation that that's the only way you get divyaganam through the diksha guru, so therefore you can only be one diksha guru, Prabhupada. You can get divyaganam from many sources and destroy sin from many sources. Any bhakti you do can destroy sin. Ajami will destroy his sin by saying Narayana once. Past, present, future karmas were all destroyed. No bhakti, in one sense. His only bhakti was chanting the name Narayana. So destruction of sin also is not a big deal for bhakti. If you bow to the deity or you follow the Ratyat or you see Jagannath, you can destroy sin that way also. No initiation, nothing. And if you get shiksha, Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavatam from a devotee of the Lord, then you get divyaganam and you can destroy your material suffering and whatever that way, and you can also advance in bhakti. So diksha, in other words, not the only means of getting divyaganam and destroying your sins, with shiksha as well.
I think there's a
booklet
called
Shikshi Diksha
where it explains all
this. Yeah. Do they have their associates and PMX as leelas?
All those forms. Well, obviously they have the consort Lakshmi. But we will not see pastimes, particular pastimes, because they are functional forms of the Lord. The Purusha avatars are actually functional forms of the Lord for creation and maintenance and destruction of the material world. So therefore that's their main element, creating the material world and, you know, witnessing it and doing all those sorts of activities rather than performing pastimes to inspire the devotees. So their main pastime is creation of the material world. That's their main pastime. Okay, ready.